This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
The secret to successfully losing your sight, it turns out, is the right sense of humour. This is, I must immediately confess, a rather dry medical pun. Humour and eyes go back a long way. The classical Greek philosophy of medicine, which held that mind and body depended on the correct balance of four fluids or humours, is, like most ancient Greek philosophies, wrong yet useful. It was the dominant theory of human health and disease from Hippocrates in 400 BC until cellular pathology was proposed in the mid-19th century. Although it has been almost entirely displaced in practice, its names live on in the body, like Pictish place names in Fife. The eye, funnily enough, celebrates Hippocrates by retaining the word humour twice in the medical description of its anatomy. It contains aqueous humour, which bathes and nourishes the cornea and lens at the front of the eye, and vitreous humour, which, despite being nearly 99% water, is a transparent structure that maintains the eyeball shape. There are many ways in which either humour can go wrong, with many sorts of sight loss as a result. They are, fortunately, too gruesome to detail here. The condition of blindness has deeper connections with ancient Greek medicine. Hippocrates applied the theory of humours to mood, saying that an excessive dark bile, melancholy in the ancient Greek, caused a lugubrious, joyless state of being. While the explanation is wrong, he and those influenced by him did form an accurate and detailed clinical description of what we now call depression. In particular, they noted that it could be dependent on events and conditions, and could sometimes be cured. It would seem obvious that losing one's sight would be a depressing, humourless experience. My world is much darker than before. A heavily overcast day can look almost like night, and that is certainly miserable in its own right. There are daily frustrations and reminders of loss, from not being able to count change to foregoing my 30-year-old addiction to Private Eye magazine. And the mythical compensations that sense are stronger, touch more discerning, hearing more acute, turn out to be just myths. Yet there are connections between blindness and depression that go beyond the fact that any acquired disability is an event that knocks you for six. Even among the disabled, blind people are disproportionately depressed, and nobody's quite sure why. There are clues. The link between moods and light is attested by much modern research that backs up Hippocrates, who noted that melancholia often gets worse as the nights get longer, the effect now known as seasonally affective disorder, or SAD. But what of us in permanent dusk? In the past 10 years, we have discovered that the eye has a whole new sense, a special ability quite separate from the normal mechanisms of sight. In particular, blue light triggers a complicated network of nerve cells only just now being explored. Some profoundly blind people, born with none of the normal light-sensing cells in the retina, can still be in some way aware of illumination even though they see nothing. They guess correctly whether a blue light is on or off, despite not knowing how. All healthy people have this sense, which we now know stimulates the part of the brain that regulates alertness. Blue light is like a constant drip feed of coffee. And, like coffee, it affects sleep. It resets the natural cycle. Too much too late into the night, and you're breaking your sleep patterns. No blue light, and you lose touch with the daily rhythm. There are strong indications that the computer industry's fondness for blue, the chances your PC's desktop came set up in that colour are better than 99%, may be responsible for quite a lot of the fatigue and sleeplessness so many enjoy. What happens if this new and mysterious sense doesn't work? We know almost nothing. There are no clinical tests for its proper functioning, and no knowledge whatsoever of what happens when it breaks. But, in cases like mine, optic nerve damage can affect any signal from eyeball to brain. Something will have happened. Medical science and I will have to wait and see just what it might be. There are plenty of other possible medical links between blindness and depression, but psychology remains the strongest suspect. Hell may be, as Sartre complained, other people, but it may also be their absence. Isolation can break a man, and blindness can be so very isolating. I realised early on in my sight loss that how I had previously reacted to people with disabilities would be how others would now treat me. My track record was not exemplary. Never one to find initial contact easy, I found it doubly hard with people who were different. It was hard to form friendships. And with people I already knew who became ill, it was far easier to drift apart, even when I knew it was happening and resolved not to let it. The ancient fear of contagion and communicable weakness, so evident in children who are quick to expel the afflicted from their circles, and the discomfort of not knowing what to say, makes it easier not to say anything, to quietly shun and exclude, or, worse, to persecute. There's little point in reiterating all the times in history that disability has been seen as a license to express cruelty, nor in enumerating the many, sometimes very ingenious, justifications given. But some very long-lasting excuses are worth a closer look. Blindness very often attracts suspicion and exclusion, as very often it doesn't look like a disability at all. Many forms show no sign from the outside that there's anything wrong, and about 9 out of 10 people with significant visual impairment, which is the legal definition of blindness, retain some ability to see light, shape and movement. So how can you tell a blind beggar from someone with good eyesight, a gift for mimicry and a distaste for honest labour? Nobody can look through your eyes to check, so it's easy to distrust. And branding people as dishonest is a convenient way to wash your hands of normal social responsibility towards them. Again, there is no need to list the reasons why that is attractive. Losing sight brings sharper awareness here. I now have an even stronger revulsion than before for an eye as a judicial principle, conflating as it does justice with revenge while denying redemption. It leads to situations such as in early medieval France, which had a particular taste for judicial blindings and a very harsh attitude to the blind. They were thought of as miserly, greedy, voracious perverts and prone, oddly, to arson. That led to all blind people acquiring an extra patina of rejection, to the point that the innocent blind had institutions created for them to hide in, out of sight. Which was just as well, as shown by one event that pops up in medieval marginalia, alongside other common entertainments, such as cockfighting and jugglers. It is recorded in detail by an anonymous hand from 15th century Paris, and involved four blind men being marched through town behind a flag and a bass drum. They were then issued with large sticks and put in a park, together with a substantially sized pig. The blind man who managed to kill the pig kept the carcass. The chronicler records with some glee the degree of damage they did to each other while thinking they were hitting the pig. Had they been truly armed, he writes, they would have killed each other. With a few tweaks, that would still work as the Monty Python sketch. It's surprisingly easy to see it as the basis of a reality TV show, although I wouldn't like to lay bets on whether the damage the participants inflicted on each other would be seen as more outrageous than the damage inflicted on the pig. It's surprisingly hard work to make empathy and compassion apply evenly. Not that empathy and compassion are much in evidence in literature. From Oedipus's blindness as punishment for incest, through Shakespeare's Gloucester in King Lear, blinded because of adultery, blindness is punishment for moral flaws. Or it is a fate too terrible to bear. Kipling's protagonist in The Light That Failed goes gratefully to his doom because his blindness was the living death. Milton's Samson Agonistes was blind among enemies, worse than chains, dungeon, or beggary, or decrepit age, inferior to the vilest now become of man or worm, the vilest here excel me. They creep, yet see. I, dark in light, exposed to daily fraud, contempt, abuse, and wrong, within doors or without, still as a fool, in power of others, never of my own. Scarce half I seem to live, dead more than half. A moving grave. It's a curious attitude from a blind poet, capable, in his darkness, of conjuring exquisite visions of heaven and restoration. Or take Blind Pew, the vilest character in Treasure Island. H.G. Wells's Country of the Blind, where a sightless community is full of xenophobic fear that makes them destroy the sight of the hero. Despairing or dismal, the constant literary theme is that blind people are different, unbridgeably so, for whom the revulsion and pity of others, or self-revulsion and self-pity of themselves, are meet rewards. But even in a society such as ours, where equality and fairness have been raised to commandments in law, blindness deeply affects how we feel one to the other. If you lose sight of faces, everyone, friend and stranger alike, wears a mask, and not smiling in recognition of somebody smiling at you marks you out as a grumpy curmudgeon, which sometimes you are. The day a ticket inspector handled my disabled rail card with obvious, almost parodic distaste before throwing it back to me without checking my tickets did nothing for my mood for some time after. It is easier to avoid encounters. Depression, proper, clinical, can't deal with anything depression, so often comes at the end point of a long spiral away from contact, either overtly or by hiding behind the facade of normality. Blindness is a shortcut through all the early stages and an accelerator thereafter. I knew where it was taking me, as I'd been there before. Was there, I wondered, a way to stop this while there was still time? It's a remarkable fact that humans tend towards a constant level of happiness despite circumstance. No matter what outrageous or outrageous blessings fortune bestows on us, within quite a short while, people tend to be as content, or otherwise, as they were before. Originally described in psychology as the hedonic treadmill, no matter how hard you work, you end up back at the same point, it's now more widely believed that people's natural point of happiness is more of a hedonic thermostat. Everyone has a different setting to which they naturally return, but it can be possible to tweak the knob. Thus, even after something as disagreeable as sight loss, one can recover one's composure and general state of light-heartedness. This is by no means guaranteed, but it is a reasonable expectation, moreover, one that can be actively sought. Recovering one's humour is a very effective answer when there's nothing else to be done, and it needs two steps. One sublime, one ridiculous. The first is to make contact on one's own terms. One of my lifelong obsessions has been technology, and one of my constant pleasures has been watching it change society for everyone. The online world exemplifies this like no other. For the first time, anyone with a story to tell can tell it to as many people as may be interested directly and with little cost beyond the time taken to pick up a keyboard and log in. This is a revolution in our culture of ideas, as sublime as you'd wish. And it has immediate practical benefits if you need to tell a lot of people quickly that you're still in the game. The ridiculous comes next. Having made contact, it helps if you make it funny. Not everyone should be the class clown, but it does have a purpose. The medieval jester, like the modern satirist, knew that truths too dangerous in the raw can be slipped in and made to stick if you laugh about them first. And so my biggest fear, isolation, I hit head on. I told people to not be scared of saying the wrong thing. I'm a firm believer in the principle that it's not enough to be given offence, you have to choose to take it. So I told everyone to assume that I was unoffendable and positively invited bad taste jokes and observations. Perhaps it helps that I've always been a connoisseur of offensive crudity and hold it in the highest esteem. Let no one tell you it is valueless. It is indeed funny to think of people laying into each other with sticks in the mistaken assumption that they're each a golden path to a bacon sandwich. And when your medicine warns you to watch for your stools turning the colour of mahogany, a wood I couldn't identify by hue even when fully sighted, the idea of taking one into an antique showroom for professional advice is irresistible. Even the way letters and words now merge into each other provokes giggles, as when a friend emails to say there's a flicker of hope about their house purchase, and the I and the L in flicker elide to look like a U. It works. For, if there's one common awareness that's always bound me to those closest in spirit, it is an underlying and quite unshakable knowledge of the absurdity of taking life too seriously when it never shows the slightest intention of repaying the compliment. As the medieval riddlers might have put it, I have eyes that see but cannot see. I find darkness with them open and light when they are closed. Seeing sadness makes me laugh. What am I? In good humour.